Good morning. The Education and Employment Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Latvala.
Here.
Vice Chair McLean. Committee Whip Andrade.
Here.
Ranking Member Williams.
Here.
Representative Alupas.
Here.
Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Barrero is excused. Representative Bush.
Here.
Representative Fine.
Here.
Representative Harding. Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hunchowski.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Mariano.
Here.
Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative McCurdy. Representative Morales.
Present.
Representative Trabulsi.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Valdez.
Present.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all electronic devices, be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters, and remember to push the microphone button after you have been recognized, as a green light on your microphone no longer represents a live mic. Good morning, members, and welcome back. I've started taking attendance a bit of my own. So before we get started, how many of y'all are either from the New England area or have been actively cheering for the Boston Red Sox the last couple of days? All right. Well, if the three of y'all can please give me the bills that you are sponsoring, I would like to look at those myself. And it's good that y'all are sitting on the ends of the dais. No. Today we will have two presentations on the development and implementation of individualized education plans. Last session, Ranking Member Williams and other members raised questions about the IEP process. Today's presentations are intended for us to learn the process and ask questions of the experts. Our first presenters are Melissa Ramsey, Vice Chancellor of Strategic Improvement, and Victoria Gontinus, Bureau Chief for Exceptional Student Education. You're recognized, Ms. Ramsey.
Good morning, Chair Latvala and members of the Education and Employment Committee. It is an honor to present to you today an overview of the process, including the development and implementation of the individual education plan process, which we'll refer to as the IEP. I am Melissa Ramsey, Vice Chancellor of Strategic Improvement over Exceptional Education, as well as English Language Learners, Federal Programs, and School Improvement. And co-presenting with me today is the Bureau Chief of Exceptional Student Education, Vicki Katanis. Today, we will be discussing the individualization of the IEP process, which customizes the services based on the needs of the student. Next, we will explain the difference of a 504 plan, as well as the multi-tiered system of support for all students. Then, Chief Katanis will explain the continuum of the IEP process, breaking down each step, including the matrix of services, which identifies the five domains of types of services, and then the five levels of support, which establishes the cost factors on the decisions made by the IEP team. She will also address dispute resolution, which dictates what happens if there's a problem or a disagreement in the IEP process, as well as Florida's trend data. Then I will cover the tiers of Florida's differentiated monitoring system, including the framework of the six key practices we use to improve all student outcomes. Lastly, we will reflect and celebrate the journey of students with disabilities and how Florida is leading the nation. Students with disabilities are students first. We align our work with the department's strategic and plan, which includes specific indicators for students with disabilities. There are approximately 2.8 million Florida public school students in our state, and 14.6%, or 405,000, are students with disabilities with IEPs. This number has been on the rise for the past 5 years. And since 2012, the number of students with disabilities in our country has risen by more than 500,000 students. There are also approximately 47,000 teachers, service providers, and paraprofessionals that support our students with disabilities. I in IEP stands for the individualization. Supports must be tailored to meet the individual needs of the student. Special education is a service, not a place, and all students are general education students first and should be privy to the least restrictive environment. The state and every district is accountable for student outcomes, and we are required to be very transparent with data and to comply with federal and state laws, as well as provide performance data specifically of students with disabilities. We also know the effectiveness of early intervention, and that's key to supporting students with disabilities as well as all students. We will go into further depth of supportive students during the developmental years when we discuss our multi-tiered support system process. In 2020-21, there are approximately 407,000 students eligible for IEPs and 123,000 students eligible for 504 plans. Now we will compare and discuss the differences between IEPs and 504 plans. The difference is the IEP provides individualized special education with a very detailed plan outlining annual goals and who is responsible for meeting the unique needs of a student based on at least one qualifying disability with data that demonstrates that the disability affects the student's academic or behavior to such an extent that the student requires special education support and services. A 504 plan is a plan for a student who has a disability that substantially limits their education. It outlines the accommodations for a student to be successful as they learn alongside their peers, as well as it outlines who's responsible for the accommodations. For an example, a student with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, may have either a 504 plan if the student needs to take assessments in a smaller class setting to limit their distractions, versus a student with ADHD that has an IEP, which identifies other health impairment as their disability. Because not only do they need accommodations for assessments, but for instruction as well in a regular classroom setting. The student's academic performance would be suffering, so this student may need to visit a resource room or have a teacher push in for small group instruction a certain amount of time per week. This would assist with comprehension and retention of materials caused by the ADHD. Hopefully, this example can clearly demonstrate the difference between a 504 plan outlining accommodations versus a very robust IEP plan that outlines student services. Now, this is the multi-tiered system of support. That's a framework for all educators providing academic and behavior strategies for all our students with various needs. It encompasses every student at every level, not just students with disabilities. Instead of waiting for failure assessment models of pre-IDEA days, MTSS takes a proactive approach to identifying students with academic or behavior needs early on. The early assessment and an intervention for these students can help with them catching up with peers sooner. The key components of MTSS include universal screening of all students throughout the school year, tiers of intervention that can be amplified in response to their needs, ongoing data collection and continual assessments, school-wide expectations and supports, and parent involvement. The integrated instructional model of MTSS uses collected data to assess student needs and provides them with interventions at the appropriate tiers. This also supports honing in on early intervention. A multi-tiered system of support organizes instruction and intervention into three tiers or levels of support that can be applied to academics or behavior. For example, in academics, Tier 1, all students would receive high-quality instruction in academics, and at least 80% of these students would succeed. In Tier 2, they would get Tier 1, and students would need additional support, such as small group intervention. This would give them a narrow focus on instruction, and this is approximately 10 to 15% of our students. And then in Tier 3, not only would they get Tier 1 and Tier 2, students would receive very intensive support based on their individual needs. And this would include problem solving, increased time, small group instruction, and even a narrower focus on their instructional needs. And this is approximately 5% of our students. MTSS tiers helps schools organize levels of support based on their intensity so that all students receive necessary instruction, support, and interventions based on their needs. This helps educators respond appropriately and provide students with assistance they need to prosper in their classroom. This flexibility of this framework allows students to move from tier to tier as needed without prescribed timelines. Now I will turn it over to Chief Gatanis.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Good almost afternoon, representatives and chair. So I'm gonna go through the seven main steps in the IEP process. In Florida, we typically refer to IEP as individual educational plan. Sometimes you may hear it also referred to as individualized education program. That's how they refer to it per the federal law and in other states. So there are seven steps you can see outlined on the diagram. It takes us through referral for services up through reevaluation. And there are some general timelines associated that are on this graph, but we're going to talk a little bit about each step in depth. And that starts with referral. So referral is when we first have a suspicion that a student may be eligible as a student with a disability. And sometimes this happens when a parent brings to us a medical diagnosis. Sometimes it happens when a teacher brings MTSS data, like Vice Chancellor Ramsey talked about before. Either way, that gives us the suspicion and documentation that the student may be a student with a disability. And when we have that, we have 30 calendar days to get signed informed consent from the parent. We can't evaluate either through a reevaluation or an initial evaluation. We can't evaluate a student without parental consent. And so we have 30 days to get that consent. And then it triggers another obligation of the school district. We call it, in special ed, we call it the child find obligation. And that obligates every district to locate and evaluate all children who are in need of special ed and related services within their corresponding area or district locale. So they don't have to serve all of those students, but they do have to locate them and evaluate them to determine if there's a need. Parents can, of course, not consent to evaluation, and if that's the case, the district doesn't violate its child find requirements if they don't evaluate. But if they feel strongly that the student needs those services, they can go through due process to get that permission. So once we have that referral and then we have that signed consent, informed consent for the evaluation, then it triggers our evaluation requirements. And that evaluation per state and federal law has to be full and individual, has to include multiple measures, because this is a problem-solving process that we do with the individual child, just like we do with multiple children in the MTSS model. It's kind of a microcosm of that. The district is required to evaluate in all areas of suspected disability, and there's a process in place if the parent doesn't agree to some of the evaluations, and that process is also dictated by the same section of law. There are some days that don't count in that 60 calendar day time frame for evaluation, and those days include, you don't have to count summer vacations or school adopted holidays, if the student is absent beyond that eighth day, if we are suspecting that the student may have a specific learning disability and the parent and the district agree that it's going to take more time to evaluate that child, we can agree to extend that timeline. And then if the student moves from one district to another, we can extend that timeline a little bit to make sure we have that full and complete evaluation in order to make determinations. So we have a referral, we have signed consent to do the evaluation, we've completed that full and complete evaluation. Now the team gets together and looks at all of that data, all of the assessments that compose that evaluation, and makes a determination whether this is a student who is a student with a disability who's eligible for an IEP. And there are two main prongs that we have to think about when we're talking about if the student is eligible. The first prong is, does the student have a qualifying disability in a qualifying category? And I'll talk about that a little bit more in the next slide. And then the second is, does the data that we're looking at from those assessments and evaluations, does that data indicate that that disability impacts the student's academic or functional performance? So if those two answers are yes, then we can move to developing an IEP. And in Florida, we have 13 disability categories. So you must qualify in at least one of these areas in order to meet that first prong that we're looking at. And some of these areas may be familiar to you, areas like autism, intellectual disability, orthopedic impairment, specific learning disability, which encompasses diagnoses like dyslexia, dyscalculia, developmental aphasia is another one. Speech-language impairment, which federally is two separate eligibility areas, but in Florida we combine them. Additionally, hospital homebound is a Florida-specific eligibility area. In most other states in the nation, it's a placement and not an eligibility area. In Florida, it's both. And then multiple disabilities, which is a separate category federally, but for Florida, we just say if you're two or more of these, then you're multiply disabled. So once we know we have a student with a disability, we've determined eligibility, that triggers the development of an IEP, and that development must consider how to deliver FAPE, or free appropriate public education. And per federal and state law, that entitlement to a free appropriate public education is for students who are age 3 through 21, so it ends at 22, for all students residing in the state. And that component of FAPE is part of the consideration when we're developing that IEP. So all of the goals and supports have to be considered through this lens of FAPE. And when we talk about FAPE in the special ed world, you'll often hear special educators and administrators refer to something called the Andrew F. IEP standard. Is a Supreme Court case that was heard in 2017, and basically it talks about the more than de minimis requirement, so that students with disabilities should have that opportunity to meet challenging objectives. We're focused on how we're preparing our students with disabilities for life after they leave us in the K-12 world. And so that means that when we're developing that IEP, it should be reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress in light of those unique and special circumstances that we've assessed and identified through the evaluation process. So that's the Andrew F. decision. We're talking about FAPE. There are other requirements when we're developing that IEP, and it starts with who's at the table. So who's at the table? We have required members that are to participate as part of this process. Includes the parents, at least one general educator. If the student's going to be educated in the general education setting, you can have more than one if there's a need. For instance, if you're looking at English language arts and math supports for a student, you might want to have both those teachers at the table. You need to have at least one special education teacher, ideally a special educator who is involved in the education or will be involved in the education of the child. And you need at least one district representative. And that district representative has to meet three criteria. So that district representative has to be knowledgeable or provide services or supervise the provision of special ed services in that district. That district representative has to know about the general education curriculum that's being delivered in that district. And that district representative has to know about the available resources for that district. And if they meet all three of those criteria, then they can be your district representative, sometimes referred to as LEA representative or local educational agency representative. You need somebody at the table who can look at and knows about those evaluations, and usually that's the school psychologist. But sometimes it can be a speech-language therapist or other related service personnel, occupational therapist, if those are concerns that you're addressing as part of that IEP process. The parent can bring somebody that they believe has special expertise to the IEP, and so can the district. And then when appropriate, the student needs to be there too, especially when we talk about transition, which we will in the next few slides. After we talk about other mandatory considerations for that IEP. So developing an IEP is a complicated process. It's fed in by a lot of state and federal laws. And so that means that we have requirements not only for considerations for who's on the team, but what we're looking at and thinking about when we're developing that IEP. And some of those things we get through the multiple data points from that initial evaluation and assessments. Some of it we have to bring to the table as a team, like considerations for least restrictive environment, which we'll talk about a little bit later, transition services, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Does the student need services beyond the school day? And that is called ESY, or extended school year. And those services can be provided before school, after school, in the summer. But if we've determined through our data that the student needs it, and there's a checklist and a whole process that governs that consideration. Is the student going to become an adult soon? We need to talk about transfer of rights. If that's the case, and usually that occurs as part of the transition process. So those are all other things we may consider as part of that process are time and frequency of services, who's going to provide those services, where they're going to provide those services. Ultimately, the IEP should be developed with enough detail so that anyone can pick it up and understand the obligations of the district to provide and support that student that's based on that data. So that's the general rule of thumb when we're evaluating IEPs for compliance that's both substantive and legal compliance. So one of the required considerations that I talked about is least restrictive environment, LRE. I know we love our acronyms in education. So LRE, this is the continuum. And we know for the most part, data and studies, multiple studies suggest, if we have those special ed students with who are exceptional student education students in general education classrooms, they have better outcomes. So law and rule asks us to the maximum extent possible to have them placed in regular education environments. But where we have data that indicates even with supplementary aids and services and supports, that's not successful, then we make that decision to move to a more restrictive environment. And that more restrictive environment can include a resource room, special classes, a separate school sometimes, or even a residential or hospital homebound placement. And this is where a hospital homebound is also a placement in addition to an eligibility criteria. Another one of those mandatory considerations that I mentioned a few slides ago was the transition IEP or TIEP requirement. Now, federally, that requirement is before 16. You have to develop a transition IEP. Prior to 2021, in Florida, that age was 14. So we started thinking about transition to life after K-12 education at 14. As a result of the statutory revisions per HB 173 in 2021, we moved in Florida to age 12 or during the seventh grade year. And this is where Florida goes above and beyond the national requirement, because we recognize that students with disabilities benefit from early planning about what comes next. So we can ensure that those students are really ready for life, that post-secondary life, their college career or life ready when they leave us. This slide outlines some steps that are important in that process when you're developing the transition portion of an IEP. It includes things like, do we need to consider deferring a diploma for a student with disability? They can have services up until they're 22. And so that's a consideration that we do as part of this process. We talk about transfer of rights during this process. We also talk about if pre-employment transition services may be needed for this student as part of this transition portion of the IEP. And then step 7, which is important, we monitor the progress. We collect data, we document the implementation of this portion of the IEP, and we view it regularly. And that feeds into the next step in the process, which is IEP implementation. So when we're implementing, we've carefully developed this IEP based on data. We've put supports in a specific into the IEP. The district's also required to document how we're providing those supports and the implementation of that IEP. And then annually, we sit down together, all the required members, and determine, is it working? Is it not working? Do we need to do more evaluations? Do we need to change services? And we look at that documentation of the implementation to make that determination. Of course, parents and districts in some cases can agree that, no, we don't need to meet this year, we're okay. Or we can meet more frequently. So if before the year is out, you see needs, a parent sees a need or a teacher sees a need, you can meet before that year is up and determine additional supports that may be needed or start an evaluation. So that's implementation. And then every 3 years, we reevaluate, which is more comprehensive. That kicks back to a really detailed another evaluation, and we look deep to say, hey, does the data indicate the student is still a student who is eligible as a student with a disability, or do we need to dismiss, or do we need to look at another eligibility category? And this reevaluation is more comprehensive than that annual look at the IEP. And of course, in some cases, we can agree not to meet for every 3 years. So those are the 7 main steps in the process. There are some additional steps that are kind of outside the process that help us attach funding to level of needs for our students with disability. In Florida, how we do this per statute is we use something called a matrix of services. And that matrix of services asks us to align that IEP with all of the goals and supports and services and accommodations to a cost factor or a funding for that student. The requirement is for districts, they have to complete it when you do an initial or a first-time IEP, and you have to do it at least every 3 years, and the person who does it has to be qualified to do it, has to have training on how to complete that matrix of service. So when we're taking a look at the IEP, that person is also looking at the matrix of services document, and we're scoring a student out based on that IEP that's individual and unique to the student in 5 main domains. And you can see the 5 main domains on this slide includes things like, what are their curriculum or learning environment needs? Do they have any needs in terms of communication, social, emotional, independent functioning? And then there's a 6th domain that's not applicable to every student, but it is applicable to some students, and that's called special considerations for students who may have a sensory impairment, who may be a Braille user or a deaf, hard of hearing. You get some additional points on the matrix for that. If a student is hospital-bound and needs specialized health care, that adds a few points too. And all of those domains individually are scored based on level of support. And then we add those up to determine overall matrix scores. But for each individual domain, we determine what the needs of the students are when we think about level of support. We also think about the level of expertise required to deliver those supports to a student. So a student scored at a level one, if they don't need any additional services or support. They look like a typical student. They don't need assistance or specialized training to move forward. And that is your level one student. Your level two, you might see words like consultative or consultation throughout the IEP, and that would be typically your level two student. And it goes up as there are increasing levels of supports and expertise needed. So your level four, you're having modification to the learning environment. You need a lot of specialized services. And then level five is continuous. So that student, for the majority of all those learning activities, needs really intensive specialized supports. They may have multiple disabilities, but that level of support is intensive and almost constant. And so when we're talking about matrix of service, then we score each domain for this, and then we score them all together. So you have a level one overall, which is typically like 251-ish, up through 255, which is your level five total score, and that's the student with the most intensive need on the matrix of service. We have to also consider for level one, who's typical, and that's based on age-appropriate norms. So when we're looking at a typical student, what's typical for a three-year-old is not typical for a 14-year-old, so that's why we have to keep that in mind when we're doing that as well. So that's the matrix of services. How IEPs look may look different depending on the district you're in. So I wanted to add some information about how IEPs are documented to this. Because districts can choose which IEP system they use, it may look a little different. Although the requirements per rule and law are the same, they may be in a different order or look a little bit different. The department offers a free system, which is called PEER, or Portal to Exceptional Education Resources, and that's used by 59 districts currently. Other options that districts may choose to use are for pay options to document commercially available systems. The most frequent that we see are Focus, Skyward for Special Ed. There are a couple of others that are used by smaller districts. And then districts can also choose to develop their own system. And the largest system that's district developed is the Miami-Dade system that's called ESE-EMS, or Electronic Management System. So that's how we document those IEPs. However they choose to document it, though, it has to have all the required components that any IEP does. So that leads us to what happens if there's a disagreement and between parents or districts regarding this process. Federally and per state law, we have three main requirements that the department administers to resolve these disputes. And those can include mediation, state complaints, or due process hearings. So due process we manage together with the Florida Division of Administrative Hearings. It's considered the most contentious form of dispute resolution. But Florida does a really good job in terms of the due process hearings. Very few of those that are filed actually get heard by an administrative law judge, and that's because they're resolved prior to actually that hearing. In fact, I think one of our administrative law judges presented to a national conference a couple of years ago to highlight Florida's success in this area. So we have very few that are heard before an administrative law judge, and then even fewer ordered actions or findings as a result of that process. And the department maintains the obligation to follow up and make sure districts do what the ordered action says they're supposed to do when that happens. We also investigate state complaints regarding students with disabilities at the Bureau. Per our obligation, we got 60 days. That's our 60-day timeline. Those are calendar days. So we have investigators working all the time on that to help. Although those being the most contentious, we encourage what we call alternate resolution, which includes mediation. And we have Florida court-certified mediators we use in Florida. Currently, our current data says 100% of those are resolved. So if we can get them to agree to go to mediation, every time, at least every time this year, they have an agreement. They're able to resolve early, and we know that's better for the student because it preserves those relationships and helps them move forward with the education and keep focused on the child and the outcome. We offer an additional thing. Of course, Florida goes above and beyond like we always do. We offer state-facilitated IEP meetings, so we train facilitators and provide the opportunity, if they both agree, to have that third party, neutral third party, sit in those IEP meetings and help facilitate agreement. And currently, our data is 100% of those are coming out with an IEP, a document, a functional document. So the good news is if we can get them there, they can resolve early, but they have to agree to get there. And that leads us to what our data looks like in terms of dispute resolution. So you can see we are increasing in, for the past 3 years in terms of number of state complaints. We saw a decrease in due process last year and decrease in mediation and facilitation use, although we have plans in place and we're talking to districts right now about how to get them to consider those alternate resolution options first before we move forward with state complaints and due process. So that wraps up my portion. I'm going to turn it over to Vice Chancellor Ramsey to talk a little bit about how we do monitoring and what the results of those monitoring are.
You are recognized.
Thank you. Not only is monitoring specific to students with disabilities, it is both federal and state requirement. When done thoughtfully, it is a critical support of the continuous improvement of student outcomes. Holding ourselves accountable means we also monitor efforts across the state and by districts, by school, providing supports when needs emerge. The department is responsible for ensuring all the requirements of IDEA are carried out and that each educational program for children with disabilities is administered in the state and meets all the educational requirements. We do this in Florida through another multi-tiered system of support based on data and the results of a very robust risk assessment. The risk assessment includes organizational and performance data, the review of stakeholder communication, fiscal and/or programmatic audit results. And for our Tier 3 on-site monitoring, not only is the district and school level educators involved in this process, students and parents are also part of the on-site monitoring process. Interviews and small group meetings are conducted to ensure that processes and procedures are systematic and communication is flowing to the caregivers of students with disabilities. The National Center of Educational Outcomes built a framework to effectively monitor educational results for all students centered on these six key practices. And we use this framework with our districts and schools to guide strategic continuous improvement of their systems and supports to ensure all student outcomes are improving, especially students with disabilities. We are using now these same six key practices that began in ESC world with all our federal programs in our monitoring processes to streamline it across every program that receives federal funds. The robust monitoring process has yielded results. Some of the highlights are increased collaboration at the district and school level between special education and general education services, improvement in key data indicators, and students are identified earlier than later to ensure improved student outcomes. As you have heard today, the IEP, or Individualized Education Plan and Process, is a very complicated one, governed by federal and state law, and therefore has many procedural and substantive compliance requirements. IEPs are and must be as unique and individual as each child, and each one should be created and tailored to support the growth and education of the student into one who is ready for life after graduation. Florida's monitoring system, combined with the hard work and efforts of those at the state, district, school level, have made Florida one of the highest performing states in terms of students with disabilities outcomes, with the highest rate of inclusion in regular education classrooms, highest graduation rate, and lowest dropout rate for our students with disabilities among the seven largest states in the nation. Not only that, Florida far outperforms the national averages when comparing our national NAEP reading scores in fourth and eighth grade for our students with disabilities. The department is committed to continuing in the provisional technical assistance and support to ensure the outlook for every Florida student with disabilities continues to be the best in this country, in part through the careful monitoring of and fidelity of the processes underpinning the development and implementation of each unique IEP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any questions? Representative Trabalsi, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation this morning. I appreciate it. So I have two sides of the coin here. My daughter was hospital homebound her entire junior year and had an IEP, and it was carried out as seamlessly as you spoke about. It was wonderful. She had a great experience, and the outcome was favorable. So thank you. On the other end of it, she is now a teacher, and she is having to, assess and put into action IEPs. Her frustration, from what I can tell, is what do we do to support our teachers and the students that may have a possible disability? What do we do to help and support them from the 30 days of evaluation to the possible 1 year of implementation? There could be a lot lost there, and it could be very frustrating on the teacher's part and detrimental to the student.
You recognize?
The MTSS process and the tiered system of support at tier one, two, or three needs to be continual through that year as identification may occur. Because again, the student as well as the teacher needs to continue that onboarding of the data along with what supports that student may need. I think some of the complication, being a former teacher myself in that same predicament, especially in the early years, is you don't know what other supports you might have outside your own classroom. And that takes a lot of district systems and support, as well as the state, ensuring that they're complying with certain requirements, especially for new teachers as well as new directors of ESC. So there's a lot of communication that must happen. And just being privy to three site visits thus far in the last 2 years, I can say I see a breakdown sometimes in the communication to a brand new teacher, because we think, oh, they've got so much going on this first year, we don't want to overburden them. But if we did give them the systems of support that they would need, it may be very helpful, especially when they have a student that might be struggling and we're waiting for something mm-hmm. to happen. So thank you for your daughter's service and knowing how well she did her junior year as well. I don't know if you wanted to add.
Sure. So a couple of things that I would do: if a teacher called up to the Bureau and said, hey, I need support for this student, we haven't gone through identification, I would point them back to MTSS. I would point them back to universal design for learning concepts. But I would also say we have some discretionary projects that we fund whose sole purpose is to support teachers in this. And those are projects like FIDLRS, the Florida Diagnostic Learning and Resource Center, they have regional centers, and they provide specialized support and technical assistance to teachers and parents specific to what you can do right now. There's nothing stopping teachers from also doing what we typically do as teachers, is talking to our peers, talking to our special educators in the building and saying, what would you do? just to provide interim supports while we're doing this process with a student. So those would be my first recommendations. And then to keep talking to us and to their district partners and district ESE department to maintain that connection together to make sure other supports that may be helpful can be deployed.
Thank you.
No problem.
Whip Andrade, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. The data that y'all mentioned at the very end about how successful students with IEPs and with disabilities are doing in Florida is incredible. But I was curious, compared to other states, how we're doing in the resolution's not the right term, but in the timely resolution from referral to implementation. Do we know if we're taking longer than other states to get to that point for students, or doing it better than other states, and kind of what you might think are the reasons for how we're doing?
You're recognized.
So the data that we report on whether or not we're meeting those timeline expectations are basically, do we meet the 30 days? Do we meet the 60? So I'll have to check in to see if we have discrete data on within those 30 days or within those 60 days, how well we're doing. For the most part, Florida is one of the top performing states with regard to meeting those timelines. So we, for the most part, I will say there are pockets of excellence when you look at it, data by district. Some districts do better at it than others, but when you compare us as a whole to other states in the nation, we typically are among the top quartile for that type of performance. Although there is definitely room to improve, especially when we look at regional data.
Follow up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I did see. So when you couple kind of the fact that there is such a robust dispute resolution process, and there's also opportunities for parents to grant waivers of that timeline. I can probably see that some parents who are true advocates are the ones who are probably going to be pushing towards that dispute resolution process, and some parents who are overwhelmed with everything else going on in their lives probably won't fight as hard because they don't have the bandwidth and probably just feel pressured to grant an extension. Is that something that y'all monitor? Is that something that y'all kind of, make sure that parents aren't in this kind of, perverse disincentive to not continue being advocates for their kids because they don't have the bandwidth?
You're recognized.
So as part of our differentiated monitoring system, one of our special education indicators is Indicator 11, and that has to do specifically with timelines. And for those districts who aren't meeting or consistently not meeting, we do that tier 2 level of review, and sometimes so that means we ask for actual documentation and take a look and see. When we go on site, we actually have the opportunity to talk to parents, and that has been especially useful for our tier 3 districts to get feedback on how they're including parents and informing parents of their rights and opportunities, supporting them to be true equal partners in that process. And that has helped with some districts in particular, them improving their parent outreach and resources to make sure that those supports are really reaching the parents that need them. But it's an evolving system. So I would say, just like with Child Find in general, there are pockets of excellence. And where we see issues emerge, we try to act with urgency to make sure we're engaging districts and parent stakeholders together to problem solve how to make that better.
Ranking Member Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to state, before I start questioning, I appreciate you putting together this presentation for us, because I know you and I have been having this conversation for the last year, and I appreciate, the presentation itself. The first question, do we have a percentage of who reports the student that needs an IEP? Is it a percentage of teachers or a percentage of the parents that's requesting the IEP, or is it just information that we just collect?
You're recognized.
So if I have it right, let me know if I don't have it right. You're asking who for the most part are making those referrals for evaluation for students with disabilities. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're right.
So basically, we don't have that data immediately, but I can look into it and see, because we have to do an individual review of processes. For referrals, basically, we say, whatever that referral, are you meeting timeline? And that's the data that we report back up to the feds. But when we do a more tier two level of review for those districts who are having difficulties meeting those timelines, then we get more discrete data about who's doing the referrals and whether those are parents or students with disabilities. I would say, after reviewing thousands and thousands of IEPs, most typically referral is initiated in your larger districts through the robust MTSS systems. So that's the primary, but in your small and rural districts, those typically come from your parents.
You recognize?
After speaking of the timeline itself, the 30 days, the 60 days, the bottom line is for us to try to assist the student as much as possible. We're talking about 30, 60, then we're talking about days that they're holidays, that they're not in school, then we're talking about the eighth day if a child is out. It seems like a long period of time in the continuum to put the child behind the eight ball. Is it anything that we could do to cut down on that time frame to assist the student in moving forth and having the IEP put together?
You're recognized.
So for the, so when we're talking about all of those days, I think you run into kind of two different problems. You know, as a district or an IEP team, you've got to do a full and complete. You want to make sure you're not missing any key areas or strategies that can help support that student. But you also want to act with urgency. Regardless of where that student is in the identification process, though, teachers and those who are working with the student should be talking to others and providing supports along the way and taking data. But I definitely, as a parent and as a long-serving educator, understand that that push and pull can be very frustrating to all parties involved.
You're recognized.
Also on page slide 14, you mentioned the parent, general educator, special educator, and a district representative. With those four people put in place, if one is out, does it continue to push the delay of the IEP back after you have done all the processes that you need to do to get the student
You're
in place? And, I'm sorry, a second
yes,
part
ma'am.
Of that. It, is there anyone else that can sit in to take place of those four people?
You're recognized.
So that's a really good question and one we get frequently. So for the for some of these, they don't have to actually physically be there in the IEP meeting if the parties agree that they want to meet without them. For instance, your general educator or your special educator can sometimes provide that feedback for the meeting in writing beforehand if both parties agree that that's okay. But if a parent really wants that person there, or wants that the voice of a specific general educator, then we try to schedule around that and make sure that whoever is really indicated as being needed for that meeting is there. But if they want to move forward with that process without it, they can agree and move forward.
Rep. Lupus, did you have a question?
You can be recognized if you acknowledge the current American League champion, please.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a technical question. So there are... recognize the current ALDS champions? Red Sox.
Thank you, Chair Latvala, and go Rays. Thank you for having some fun, and I do appreciate the presentation. Mr. Chair, may I be recognized for a series of questions?
Yes, ma'am, but keep in mind there's another presenter. Some of the questions that we have asked or have been asked go into what the next presenter will be talking about, so just keep that in mind.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, again, thank you very much for your presentation today. And if we go back to... slide 5. In a micro manner, what does this multi-tiered system of support looks like for all students. What does that process look like in trying to figure out what all students need or each child needs at that point?
You're recognized.
I go back to my days as a teacher and a principal. Knowing a multi-systems of support would be that based on my current progress monitoring data, I can see what students may have gotten a skill or concept of a standard and which ones didn't, and then able to do small group instruction to see if they can gain that strategy or skill to understand that standard, reassess, and then bring them back to the next level. So when you're talking about the three tiers, tier two being that there are going to be students that don't get that skill. So it's a chance to either push in or pull out services to ensure in real time where you don't have to wait for a student to be classified as a student with disabilities to give them resources and services. So multi-tier system of support allows for all students to receive that. And a tier three student, if you see that they're continuing, their data is just not there and they're continuing to show in the red and you're trying different strategies and they're not working, that's when a referral can happen too. And simultaneous that referral and process and timeline that we're worried about being so long and robust, you can still be giving a student services in a general education classroom.
Representative, you can ask one more question, then we're going to move on to the next presenter. Okay. And then after that, we can go back to, if y'all don't mind staying, we'll, if we have time, we'll go back to questions for you.
Thank you. My question is, I'm concerned about our high school students towards the end of their career with us. So with the unexpected state board rule changes that happen in the spring, and we're talking about those access points, so how will the student in high school currently be able to graduate with the same standardized diploma, considering that if they're in their third year, their senior year, and they have to be reevaluated on the way out? So how does that work?
You're recognized.
That's a really good question. And one of the things that we talk about when we talk about students with disabilities, and when districts or parents ask this question to the Bureau, I say, let's start with how ready, what do we know about this student? Because if this is already a student with a disability, we've already done a transition IEP, how ready is this student for life after us through K-12? Have we been doing our robust array of supports to make sure that they're ready? We also have that consideration for deferral, and that really is a consideration that we think about. So can we add services both, you know, in the summer and maybe defer that diploma to make sure that when that student leaves us, they have the opportunity to be successful post-secondary? And that was primarily the result of students coming to us saying, I graduated on access points. I wasn't supposed to be on access points. I want to go to the police academy. I can't now without doing a whole nother, you know, getting a GED or something like that. And so those students started to come to us and share those concerns. And so we wanted to put a fence up to make sure that the IEP teams are thoughtfully considering how they're making sure that those students are ready for life after us. So I think it starts with what can we do right now to make sure that they're ready when they leave us? Do we need to extend that timeline and defer diploma? And do we need to also consider additional things like extended school year support?
All right, thank you. Just keep that in mind for after our next presenter. Okay. And if y'all don't mind hanging around, we would appreciate it. Before we go to the next presenter, though, I want to take a quick moment of personal privilege and recognize, and perhaps to help my dear friend, Rep. Lupus. We have a city council member from the finest county in Florida and home to the current AL champion, Tampa Bay Rays, and that is in Pinellas County, and that is Katie Gannon, who is the Oldsmar city council member who's in the audience today. Thank you very much for being here. Our second presenter is Melissa Musselwhite, Director of Student Support Programs and Services, who is on our screens. And you are recognized, Mrs. Musselwhite. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good afternoon, Chairman and members of the Education Committee. I'm Melissa Musselwhite, the Director of Student Support Programs and Services in Pasco County Schools. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Before walking you through the sample IEP, I thought about really an example that many of us may have some experience with that could give you some perspective on timelines for implementation of an IEP. As Bureau Chief Gattanis shared, there are timelines for considering if a student has a disability and then determining if indeed they need specially designed instruction. Then the team has to come together and write an IEP. So I want you to think about those who wear glasses and know that those glasses are made specifically for you to accommodate your needs. Before you get glasses, you have to go to an eye exam to determine what your vision needs are. This includes completing a health history, maybe a vision test, a pupil test, those eye pressure tests that we all hate. And those tests tell the optometrist what your eye prescription is so that you can be recommended for the glasses that best meet your needs. Based on your symptoms, you may need single vision lenses, you may need multifocal lenses, you may need bifocals, or maybe something else. Without the correct prescription, you may not be able to complete daily tasks, things as simple as reading or even driving safely. Because everybody's eyes are different and pairs of glasses are made for one person, if you wear someone else's glasses, they actually may cause you harm and you may not be able to perform certain tasks. So when you think about the process it takes to get eyeglasses, you have to make an appointment, you have to go to the appointment, you have to fill out paperwork, you have to complete the eye exam, you get the results, you pick out your glasses, you order your glasses and lenses, you get them fitted, you possibly get them refitted, and you even may be referred to a specialist. So you think about how long does that take? In my experience, those processes take 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours. And it may possibly take multiple appointments. So then let's think about that in the context of an IEP before we look at a draft IEP that I've shared with you. An IEP, like it has been shared with you, is written for each individual student. Data is gathered from multiple stakeholders, including parents, students, and teachers. And the data that's collected is used to determine the support and services students need in order to access the curriculum. An IEP should tell the parent, the students, the teachers, and other staff which special education services the school should be providing. And that will include things like behavioral support, assistive technology support, planning for high school graduation are just a few. The process of developing an IEP includes sending out an invite, just like your appointment for an eye doctor. It has to be at a time that's mutually agreed upon between the school team and the parent. You have to gather input from teachers, from students, from parents, and you have to review the data that's been gathered. What has been successful for the student? What has been unsuccessful? What are the student's current strengths? What are the current student's needs? What possible accommodations may the student need? Then a draft IEP is developed and a meeting is held to finalize that document. During those meetings, conference notes are taken to really document what is being discussed, making sure that the parent is providing an opportunity for meaningful input and the reasons for the team decisions. So then I ask you, how long do you think it takes for a team to complete the process of developing an IEP? I talked to a couple of my teachers just recently to see, you know, what time frame is it taking you from start to finish, from the meeting invite to finalizing everything? And they expressed to me, on average, it takes 4 to 5 hours for each student. That is required in order to be sure that we are providing intensive interventions that meet the students' needs and that the IEP is legally compliant based on all the factors that the previous presenters shared with you. So now I'd like to take an opportunity to move you into the draft document. I I believe you also have a copy of this document, so you can follow along, and I will be referencing page numbers for ease of use for you. I briefly discussed initially about the meeting invite, and on the meeting invite, which I did provide you a copy of, I wanted to be sure to let you know that on that invite, the school must list the reasons for the meeting and all the attendees that will be participating. And just as there were timelines discussed earlier, there are also timelines in regards to when you have to give a parent notice. You have to give a notice for at least 7 days, and in specific circumstances, that notice could be up for 10 days in order that the parent has enough notice to be able to have meaningful participation. In addition to that, Bureau Chief Catan has discussed all the IEP team membership. And so that could range from, as we discussed, a gen ed teacher and an ESE teacher. But also, if the child receives related services, that can include multiple other team members. So if a teacher, if a student has a learning disability, they may have an ESE teacher. But also, if they need speech and language services, there may be a speech language pathologist. Or if a student is hearing impaired, there may be a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing. So while some IEP teams could just be a handful of people, other IEP teams could be up to 10 people, so that they're able to discuss the needs of the student and being able to plan effectively for the student's needs. This is a sample IEP for Frank F. And you'll see here, Frank, this top portion is all his demographic information. Some key components that I would point out to you is that you will see the IEP date and the duration date and the review date. This is important because annually IEPs must be reviewed and updated. In addition to that, you'll see the reevaluation due date, and at least every 3 years, if not more frequently, teams must meet to discuss a reevaluation for the student. The other items that you will see here are the primary and other exceptionalities of the student with disabilities. And so you will see this student has a primary exceptionality of intellectual disability and other exceptionality of language impairment. It's always really important to make sure all this information is correct. And so this is where the team always starts with the parent to review this information and ensure that it's correct with demographic data. The next section of the IEP is the special considerations. And these are factors that the IEP team, including the parent, must consider to be ensure that all of these needs are addressed in the IEP if they are marked yes. And you will see on this document that there are things in here, everything from does the student have behaviors that impede their ability to learn, to if they have sensory impairments such as vision impairment or deaf and hard of hearing. There is also additional questions related to English proficiency, and then finally some assistive technology needs. And so as you go through these special factors and they're identified as yes, like I mentioned, then these will be addressed in the student's IEP in various portions. Two additional areas that I would point out to you is the IEP teams consider if a child is able to participate in physical education or if they need adaptive physical education objectives in order to access that program. And then finally listed here is information about CAPE with regards to career and professional education. And so IEP teams consider what type of opportunities for industry certification that the student may be seeking. As we move on to the next page, you will see this is a student who is in high school, but for students who are 14 years and older, we now address high school graduation opportunities. And you will see for Frank that he intends to want to work in a hospital for his post-secondary opportunity. And so the team will have to consider these opportunities for his post-high school planning and access to outside resources such as vocational rehab. This next section talks about domains and transition activities, and then all the areas here that are marked yes get addressed through the goals and objectives in the IEP. When you get to page 3, the general factors and assessment data. This is all information that is gathered from the school team. So you will see that you will find that there are statewide or district-wide assessments results included. You will see that the parents' concerns are listed here. If a student has any health concerns, they would be included here. In addition to that, this is a portion where you will see some of the interagency linkages that we make with community providers that are, whether they are responsibilities of the agency or linkages needed. And so for Frank, you will see here that we were doing some linkage to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation during his senior year to help him transition to the workforce and potentially include supports for college and technical school. So that is always a valuable activity that starts occurring during the student's high school experience. Again, this is a high school student, and so you will find in the IEP that there are transition components, and they review the transition activities that Frank will need to complete. And so you will see here that there's an interview with Frank so that we really are aware of what his post-school outcomes are long-term. And then you'll see some short-term goals in order to assist him to meet those. And so some of the short-term goals you'll see are set within 3 months that he will complete some employment training. He will also look at obtaining some opportunities at local hospitals. And he also is looking to live independently with roommates in order to help him support with his daily needs. There are more aspects here about transition activities, and this outlines that Frank is pursuing the standard diploma and he is enrolling in access programs and he is taking the alternate assessment and does not require a waiver for graduation. And then you'll also see down here some additional information that was included is about a paid work internship before the end of the school year. And that will be with the assistance of the outside agency linkage with vocational rehab. Then the document really from page 5 to page 10 moves into present level of academic achievement and functional performance. And this again can range from academic to independent functioning to communication skills. Early on the document on the first page, you saw those check boxes. And so any of those areas that were marked yes, you will see for each one of those areas that they outline what Frank's strengths are in that area, what data, whether it was informal or formal, what observations, work samples were gathered in order to address this specific domain and transition area. And then when you move farther down, you will see that the student's disability affects their involvement in the gen ed curriculum, and they outlined how and what the impact of that is. And then finally, as a part of the independent functioning domain, you will see that there is an annual goal and short-term benchmarks written. And so these are written in a way that says Frank will seek assistance or treatment from healthcare provider when he does not feel well. And so they're teaching him about his needs for healthcare under this independent functioning domain. You will also see that they have set some short-term benchmarks that he will alert his teacher and supervisor when he's not feeling well. And also he will begin asking permission to see the nurse or healthcare provider when he's not feeling well. So this domain, there's a couple of additional annual goals and benchmarks, but you will see that those are related to his healthcare. As we move further in the document, on to page 7, you will begin seeing that these are more academic based, where you will see the involvement of the speech language pathologist really assisting Frank in including details in relation to WH questions, who, what, when, where, why, to explain a situation or questions. And then this one is again another goal in relation to instruction with mathematics and reading. And so you will see again that they list out what his strengths areas are, and then they move right into how that impacts the nature of his disability, impacts his ability to access the gen ed curriculum. And then you will see, again, the annual benchmarks and goals. So again, that is pages 5 through 10 in this portion of the IEP. So I'm going to scroll past those very quickly so I can move to the other sections of the IEP. All right. When you get to page 11, you will see a section talking about participation in assessment. And so this is where the IEP team determines if a child will take the general statewide assessments, currently the FSA and the end of course exams, or if the child will take will participate in the Florida Standards Alternate Assessment. And so you will see for this student, Frank F., he was met the criteria, which has changed since the last session. But based on when this was written, he met the FSAA participation guidelines. And so the team determined that as appropriate. Additionally, you will see that there are assessment accommodations listed on an IEP. And what's key during the IEP process is there are some assessment accommodations, or I would say classroom accommodations, that cannot be used on assessments. And so they are delineated separately on this document. And so in this section, you will see the actual assessment accommodations that are provided to Frank. Those include things like oral presentation, extended time, assistive technology, such as an audio recorder. So those things are listed there. And then we move into really what is happening day to day in the classroom. And so you'll see here that Frank is receiving specially designed instruction in areas for all academics, communication, self-determination, self-advocacy, and community-based instruction. This outlines when those will be occurring. So it's throughout the entire year of this document. And it also says the frequency, whether it's daily, weekly, monthly, and the location that those supports will be provided. In addition to that, you'll see the related services listed, and you'll see that Frank receives language therapy for 60 minutes a week in the therapy lab. He also gets school health services. He gets specialized transportation, and he gets transportation to those community-based instruction activities. Additionally, he receives some supplemental aids and services, and so you'll see there that he gets some instruction from the assistive technology specialist. In addition to that, Frank requires additional adult supervision daily, and so those are important things for individuals to know that look at an IEP, to know that Frank isn't a student that you can just, you know, send to the office without supervision, that he is somebody that needs additional adult assistance throughout the day, as outlined on his IEP. Early on in the document, in some of the special considerations, extended school year was marked, and so annually, the team has to consider if extended school year is needed for a student. And then, but this doesn't always have to happen at the beginning of the school year. And so that's one thing to keep in mind is if a parent has an IEP meeting in August and they develop the IEP and extended school year services aren't recommended, the school team or the parent can request a meeting at any time during the year to convene to discuss extended school year. Because sometimes a child's needs change throughout the year, and while a team may not have recommended them in August, the team may want to reconsider. And so that, I would say, is one area that we get a lot of requests for more frequent IEP meetings is in the spring, whether it's done by the school team or the parent to consider. These are the additional classroom accommodations that are provided. So they look a little bit different than the ones that were provided for assessments, but many of them are exactly the same. And typically they should be the same because if a student needs those in the day-to-day classroom and they're permissible on the assessment, they should be duplicated. And then likewise, you can't just give an accommodation to a student during an assessment. It would be something that they need, and we should have data to support that that's a needed accommodation daily. And then you'll see some additional accommodations regarding to scheduling, settings, and assistive technology devices. One area I really wanted to point out to you, this is a key area in some meetings that we talk about, is we really want school staff to advocate also. If there's something that's included on the IEP that they're not familiar with or need training, that's where we would include it here about supports for school personnel. And this talks about that school personnel wanted instruction and assistance on how Frank would use his audio recorder in class. And so I would say many times school teams also need to advocate for what training and support they need, whether it's from the district or a discretionary project, in order to make sure that they're able to implement the goals and benchmarks that they've agreed to on the IEP. And then finally is least restrictive environment. I know Bureau Chief Catan has talked a little bit about least restrictive environment. And so as she mentioned, in Florida, we do a great job with keeping most students spending at least 80% or more of their school day in the gen ed classroom. But there are for some students that need a more restrictive environment. And so for Frank, he is educated in a separate class, which means he spends, he's inside the regular class less than 40% of his school day. But the nice thing to know is that he is spending some time with his gen ed peers, and every year the team continues to consider what additional support can be provided for students to give them access to the gen ed curriculum and gen ed peers to the maximum extent possible. And then finally, I'll close with saying there are other requirements with regards to transfer of rights for students when they turn 18 that the IEP teams have to discuss. And then finally, one thing that I talked about early on that I would love to highlight is I find conference notes to be probably one of the most important parts of the meeting, because they really can outline what the parent input is, what was agreed upon and not agreed upon. We use the peer system like Bureau Chief Catan has discussed, and while it allows for some flexibility, sometimes you just can't capture the essence of the discussion in the formatted document. And that's where the conference notes are key in providing the ability to document that information. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, members. We have 7 minutes left. We're not extending. I know we had some questions left for the first set of presenters. Is there any questions for Mrs. Musselwhite? Very concise questions. Very quickly, Representative Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Chair Latvala. I appreciate it. So thank you very much for your presentation as well. Is it possible that the new State Board of Ed rule could mean that Frank, in this example, won't graduate with a standard diploma and pursue post-secondary education? Or could this, or could he end up in that road to nowhere in a certificate of completion?
Is that, we're on questions for Mrs. Musselwhite?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Based on her experience.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You're recognized, Ms. Musselwhite.
Great, thank you. We're in the process of reviewing each student based on the new criteria. There will be situations of students that potentially were on a course for with access standards that may not meet the new criteria. We are working with the Bureau to discuss those specific students to determine the next course of action like was described. But there could be situations that does occur, and we would have to consider the opportunity like discussed for deferral and the student staying till their 22nd birthday.
Any other questions for Ms. Musselwhite? Ms. Ramsey and Ms. Gantanis, I think we had some questions for you. Representative Lupus, you're still in the doghouse, but I will be nice and recognize you for a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Technical question. So there are 8 school districts that are not using the PEER program. They have to meet, I imagine, some sort of basic core competencies. What are the and one of them is my school district, Miami-Dade County. What are the differences that you're seeing in the systems, and why is there not a consistent system across the entire state?
You're recognized.
So the reasons for using a different IEP system than the PEER system vary across districts. I know we are in a county that doesn't use the PEER system. Sometimes they would prefer, we evaluate each IEP that we get, and we see for compliance. Sometimes that means for those commercially purchased products, we go back to districts and say, you're missing this component, work with your individual contract to make sure you've added this into it, because there are frequent changes in legislation that require that. So that can be a reason why they might. Now, of course, Miami developed their own because they're too big to go on peer right now. We don't have the bandwidth in the server space to take Miami-Dade right now. So they developed their own, but it's a pretty good system. Does that answer the question?
Representative Valdez, did you have a question for them? You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the previous question, you had mentioned that, here it is. I thought we did away with the special diploma years ago. So the young man that you described that wanted to be a police, that wanted to go into the police academy, if they get a standard high school diploma, wouldn't they automatically qualify, or are you putting dings on their diploma for not being able to, or is there an indicator that says you can't go into this career? You really confused me when you said that.
You're recognized.
So just like for any program, when a student graduates, they can graduate via the access points venue or via the standard diploma, general curriculum venue. And if a student graduates on access points, that means that has to be indicated on their transcript. So graduating on alternate, we call them alternate academic achievement standards, has an impact because, of course, those courses have to be indicated on the transcript for the student, and it can limit their post-secondary outcomes. So I think it's helpful probably to go back and talk about the federal law that says that states can, if a state has alternate academic achievement standards, which Florida does, they have to assess on those standards, and only students with the most significant cognitive disabilities can be assessed using an alternate academic achievement standards assessment like the FSAA. So, and that reason that is because if you use alternate academic achievement standards, which are reduced from the general standards in both complexity and rigor, that can have an impact, and it does have an impact on many students' post-secondary options because you have to indicate that on the transcript, and that means, for instance, they may be prohibited from entering police academy or law enforcement or serving in the military or even attending some post-secondary training opportunities that it may exist for students who graduated with under general standards. That all being said, we ask also that reevaluation component comes into play here too, where districts have to carefully consider and look at the data to say, does the student continue to qualify on the alternate access points? We call them access points, alternate academic achievement standards, or whether or not we need to start a transition and make available that instruction on those rigorous standards, general education standards.
All right, thank you. Thank you all to all the panelists for joining us today and for the members for their thoughtful questions. Thank you for your attention and participation. Vice Chair McLean moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.